You're listening to a program produced in 2016 by Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place at the historic Central Library in downtown Los Angeles. Aloud is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more, please visit lfla.org/aloud. In 1996, in his introduction to the anthology From a Burning House, which was a collection of writing from the AIDS Project LA anthology, playwright Tony Kushner wrote, quote, AIDS is both a destroyer and a creator of community. It is, after all, not a single entity, but a syndrome with ill-defined boundaries and categories, and as such it spreads both biologically and politically, dismantling but also forging connections by uniting in pain and in anger people with very different histories and lives, helping to clarify which lives are regarded as dispensable by America's ruling class. Those in the margins, unless united in resistance, die. So AIDS is also about resistance. AIDS is, and I hesitate to write this, Kushner concluded, about life. We the living are here tonight to honor World AIDS Day, December 1st, which was designated by the UN AIDS in 1988 to be observed on December 1st every year to raise awareness of the AIDS pandemic caused by the spread of the HIV infection and to mourn those who died of the disease. Tonight we join with the City of West Hollywood, thank you Corey Roskin, and the One National Gay and Lesbian Archives, thank you Joseph Hawkins and staff, to mark World AIDS Day by celebrating the publication of David France's magnificent new book, How to Survive a Plague, the inside story of how citizens and science tamed AIDS. David's book will help ensure that the epidemic's early days will not disappear in the fog of history. More than ever, we need to learn from this book how the terror and confusion of dark times can engender disparate and often dissonant forces that can fight it. How to Survive a Plague has been called, quote, a masterpiece of intimate storytelling by Andrew Solomon, and it follows by a few years the film documentary, which you saw a clip from, by David France, which I watched this morning on my couch, sobbing, thinking of all those beautiful souls who died so young. Among them, many, for me, my friends and fellow artists, Jose Brown, Philip Justin Smith, David Redford, Ken Regg, just for starters, and I know you have your own lists. Our distinguished guests tonight include author David France, here from New York, who is also the author of Our Fathers, a book about the Catholic sexual abuse scandal. David co-authored The Confession with former New Jersey Governor Jim McGreevy. His documentary film, How to Survive a Plague, which you can rent on Netflix, and I strongly recommend it, was an Oscar finalist, won a Directors Guild Award and a Peabody, and was nominated for 2 Emmys, among other honors. And we have Dr. Mark H. Katz, a physician activist who served on the front lines of the affected HIV community in Southern California for 30 years. He's been affiliated with Kaiser Permanente West LA from 1992 to 2006. Dr. Katz was regional HIV physician coordinator for Southern California Kaiser region. He's also a longtime educator as well as an activist and the recipient of many honors, but his greatest professional reward, he says, is, quote, continually having the opportunity to be involved in the care of people who face the challenge of HIV with such grace and determination. And our moderator tonight is Tony Valenzuela, Executive Director of Lambda Literary, the nation's leading nonprofit organization advancing LGBTQ literature. Tony is a longtime community activist and writer whose work is focused on LGBT civil rights, HIV/AIDS, and gay men's health, and he's credited with having ruptured the conventional wisdom in HIV/AIDS prevention among gay men by launching an international debate regarding sexual health beyond condom use. It's a really distinguished panel. Please join me. First of all, I wanted to tell you we will have questions from you at the end. If you can ask your question as a question, that's always appreciated. We'll circulate microphones to you so that we can hear you. We hope to have the podcast of this program up soon. Afterwards, David will be signing his books in the lobby, courtesy of the library store. Please stay and we can talk for a little bit in the lobby. Please welcome our distinguished panel to the Los Angeles Public Library. Thank you.
So, welcome. I'm Tony Valenzuela. Welcome all of you and our special guests tonight, David France and Dr. Mark Katz. Also thanks to Louise Steinman and Aloud series, which is such a wonderful series here in Los Angeles. So as I read David's book, I kept placing myself, where was I when the New York Times reported on a rare cancer in 41 homosexual men, when Rock Hudson died in 1985, when Reagan officially addressed the epidemic in 1987. I was a kid, mostly, the generation that came of age when condoms were already the norm, and when my fears about coming out were tied also to the terror of getting AIDS. For many people in this audience tonight, this book about the plague and its response, whether they were in New York or not, is very much their story too, having experienced before and after AIDS. For many others, whether because they were too young or not in the gay community, it's a story that affected them indirectly or took more time to impact them in different ways. I want to keep that in mind as we discuss the book and later as we take questions that people are coming to this history with a different relationship, with different relationships to the epidemic. So, David, to begin, I want to talk about your chronicle of the early years of the epidemic following Dr. Joseph Sonneben, the gay clinician in New York City, trying to figure out why so many of young gay men in his practice were falling ill. Those chapters were remarkable to me in their unfolding horror and mystery. What was that time like for you moving to New York as it was becoming clear something new and frightening was afflicting gay men?
I had a little slower realization than the doctor did and some of his early patients. I read that first report in 1981 in the New York Times with suspicion. You know, the New York Times, and in fact every media outlet in the country, had been lying about gay people forever. And I took it as just another lie. It certainly captured my attention and animated conversation between me and my friends, but I just missed it. It didn't help that it was called somehow a disease that sought out and attacked only gay people, and that the CDC, in the very last line of the New York Times article, swore that it really wasn't that big of a danger to other people. So that just seemed, you know, just like more slander. It took me a number of years before I really swallowed the realization that something terrible was happening. It was actually 1983. It was after the first AIDS patient who had ever gone public on television. His name was Ken Ramsauer. After he died, there was because he had become such a hero, although he died 4 days after the piece aired on ABC, there was a massive outpouring of people in Central Park to commemorate him, and there were something like 1,500 people there, and probably every sick person in New York. I mean, it was, you could see it. It was the first time I saw it, and it was the first time for me it was an undeniable plague. You know, you saw people in wheelchairs, you saw people, young people, grimacing in pain, and so apparently near death, and I could no longer blame it on the New York Times. I had to accept that that something terrible was happening.
Mark, when was the moment that you knew there was an epidemic among gay men? I know you came to L.A. in 1985. Right. What was that early realization like for you?
Sure. But prior to 1985, I was living in Wisconsin, thinking about how I would have a meaningful career, doing something alternative. And I remember coming to my first AIDS meeting in New York in 1983, talking about all the different etiologies and feeling somewhat safe and insulated because I didn't know anybody in Wisconsin when I left on January 3rd, 1985, who had AIDS. In my life in Los Angeles, my exposure was at the LA Shanti training that summer in July of 1985, where I met people with AIDS for the first time, two out of 90 volunteers acknowledged that they had AIDS, and it seemed like the community was out to help them. But then October 2nd of 1985, I was at my first LA clinical AIDS meeting out in the City of Industry run by Dr. Martin Finn. And I'll never forget, in the afternoon, a sudden pallor came over his face and he got up to the podium and said, "We've just learned that Rock Hudson has died." Mm-hmm. And there was something about, something was galvanized at that moment between the Shanti training for me in July on a personal level and what I felt collectively in the fall of 1985, that we knew something was really wrong. That same month, coincidentally, my first person who I knew in Madison, Wisconsin, was diagnosed with AIDS.
I was struck by how many of the epidemic's sort of central themes took root so early, as I was reading, especially the early part, the early years of the epidemic, mm-hmm. that this was a crisis, that gay men needed to be self-reliant, that the response would by necessity be community-based. And yet one part of that early history that took a little longer to figure out was the cause. Was it promiscuity? Was it the immune system being overloaded by STDs? Was it a single infectious agent or poppers?
Or was it homosexuality itself?
Or was it homosexuality?
Was being promulgated, yeah, but somehow.
Right. Why was the cause debate so fraught with venomous community politics at the time? And if you could both talk about that.
Well, it was, you know, 1981 was, of course, just a little over, you know, 10 years into the gay movement, to the modern gay movement. And the 70s, after the Stonewall riot in 1969, the 70s were really institution building, community building, a celebration for the first time of gay love, of gay community, of gay family, of gay sex, and really using the language of love and sex to help build the community. And the idea that some disease might have come out of that seemed to be a direct assault on the way that the movement had taken shape and what its goals and practices were. So there were a lot of people who didn't want to associate it with sex. And as long as there was no evidence to associate with sex, they thought it was way premature to be doing that and to be making any recommendations to gay people about what to be doing behaviorally in response to this kind of growing mm-hmm. health crisis. The story that I detail in the book is about one of the early doctors, Dr. Joseph Sonnabend, who was a research bench scientist with a great deal of experience. And as a researcher and a clinician, he had the idea that you had to not narrow down but broaden and put everything on the list. He was particularly worried that a virus was going to be part of this, because he thought that if it were a virus, then containment of the virus would entail, possibly quarantine or other sort of draconian measures that would take gay people already clearly ostracized and disenfranchised and criminalized. Homosexual practice was illegal in most states. It was not, possible to hold most jobs in most fields if you were openly gay. So he was afraid that there was just going to be this total backlash that was going to involve a rounding up of gay folks. There's a bunch of fear that was attached to any one of the possible causes. And all of that fear had foundation in reality. Mm-hmm. So people took their own, they bet on this cause or that cause, hoping that it would not bring this awful conclusion or that awful conclusion. Mm-hmm. But it was just clear early on that it was going to be awful. So
yeah, I have to admit, when I was reading it, there was a part of me that was surprised at sort of the mystery around it being a sexually transmitted disease. Right.
Because obviously it is, we know that now.
Right, exactly. But that there were these years where that was really debated was interesting and just a story I hadn't known.
Right. I won't defend the homophobia and the other things that happened to known to everybody in this room, which might have put a delay on that, but I would make a couple of points about the medical model that retroviruses were not discovered until 1970, a decade before the epidemic. So the idea that this was a different critter, now retrovirus was not recognized as the cause until 83, 84, but once we did recognize it, this was something that we did not have a way in the medical model of a virus that doesn't just attack a cell, but it attacks a cell and reproduces inside the cell, turning it into a virus factory. We had never seen that before. And secondly, physicians, I remember that meeting in New York in 1983 and the segments about poppers, about, you know, immune suppression, about a virus. Physicians, by and large, have a difficult time saying, we don't know what's going on, or we're wrong about this. And AIDS, as my husband Bob always says, is society's Drano. It goes right to the place where there are problems. And the medical community was really swatted across the face to be able to say, you know, we're not sure. I also say, Tony, in regards to what you just said, let's remember this was a pre-internet age, and I'm wondering how communication was. I mean, I was alive at the time. Most of us were. things didn't happen, I guess, that quickly. But again, add to that all the political homophobia and you know, phobia of people using drugs as came out later. I think that's part of what we were seeing. A formidable obstacle in a society not prepared for it.
Well, and the gay community really wanted to know what to do. And so our folks were looking for those solutions kind of more aggressively than anybody else because we were at risk and we didn't know what was putting us at risk. Mm. And the very, very first theory among the first activists was it was just overexposure to sexually transmitted diseases. And maybe even to semen itself. Like there was a theory that it was actually a very interesting study that men are allergic to other men's semen, and it turns out it's true. I mean, but who would have thought to study something like that before? But women aren't allergic to semen, so so then there was a theory that maybe it was just exposure to that, and so stop exposing yourself to it, and then. If you take yourself off the circuit, you can get well. So there were a lot of people who were doing that as well.
Right. And
but as you point out, that was really 2 years of that kind of befuddlement. Right. And by 1983, there was a consensus that this was passing from person to person through some sort of bodily fluid contact. And that's the year that we saw the advent of safe sex, which was still based on a theory because we hadn't found a virus, that if you don't exchange fluids, then you might keep yourself safe.
And David's book, just to give a plug, we're all here tonight to celebrate it. The way you describe Michael Callan, he's not the only one, but the way mind worked into getting into safe sex, the creation of the whole concept, the creation of how do we protect ourselves without the society giving us a blanket is masterful. It's one of the things about your book that just whipped me right there, and I so appreciate it.
David, I was fascinated by the safe sex origin story involving Richard Berkowitz and Michael Callan, both of whom would go on to have such a profound effect on gay male culture. Mm-hmm. It was, for me, a great example of how navigating sexual health would grow out of the lived experiences of gay men that affirmed our humanity. And not necessarily listening to a group of medical professionals telling gay men what to do, because at the time, as you described, many medical professionals thought it was insane that gay men would consider any intimacy at all. Mm-hmm. How did these two ordinary guys change gay men's sexual practices in such a profound way?
Well, they were both patients of Joe Sonnabend's, and they both were somehow drawn to a public life in the epidemic very early on. They wanted to play some positive role. And neither had come with any credentials. They had no portfolio. Richard Berkowitz was a sex worker. And Michael Callan was a cabaret singer, although at the time a kind of a failed cabaret singer. Hadn't really invested in that part of his career. And both saw the need to give messages of hope and practical care to the community. And they began to write together. which was also something they hadn't done before. And they started writing for the New York Native, which was a local newspaper in New York. It was the equivalent of Facebook back then.
Right.
When something appeared in the Native, everybody dove for it, and the community was informed, at least the community that was connected kind of in the ghetto below 14th Street in Manhattan. And they were rejected by readers at the time in their early messages. It was in 83 that they came up with the idea of safe sex, and they came up with it just... It was Richard Berkowitz who came up with it. He had quit his practice when he seemed to be immune compromised and was getting very poor. Like, you can't make a living writing for the gay presses. He really wanted to go back into business, but he didn't know how to do it. And he just needed the money. His clients were begging him to get back in the business. And he practiced a sort of sex trade that leaned towards sadomasochism and bondage and discipline. And it occurred to him in 83 that you can't really make somebody sick by tying them up. You know, that it just doesn't make sense.
Right. You said that this client who was really being persistent about wanting to see him again
right. Just
said, you know, lace up your boots, I want to worship
just
them.
Just put the boots on.
Right, yeah. Exactly. And that's
goes,
when
the boots
light bulb
aren't
went
up. Yeah. You know, he went to his doctor and told him about it, and he said, can somebody catch something from licking my boots? And he said, have you been on a farm? You know, like, you know, it goes back to the old science, not the new science. So then he started writing down all the things a person could do, starting out in his own wheelhouse, but expanding out, and made a list of things that he took again to Dr. Sonnabend and said, can these things transmit disease or break down the immune system in some way or in some way imperil people? And with his doctor's help, he kind of ranked them into, you know, absolutely safe, possibly safe, and unsafe. And he realized that what he had done was developed a how-to guide.
Yeah.
For the community to still practice, you know, on their sexual urges, which was really essential. You can't take sex away from it from a people, and yet keep themselves safe. And the very last thing that he added, I remember this, that they produced this 16-page bulletin, and they're going to distribute it themselves because they had been shut out of the gay presses because they were so controversial.
This that was called How to Have Sex in an Epidemic.
How to Have Sex in an Epidemic. It's really a seminal publication. And I didn't mean that. Who are these people? what was I saying? Oh, so they make this and they read it to one another, and they get to the very end, and Michael Callan's boyfriend goes, you've written, you know, 16 pages of text and you don't mention love once. Hmm. And they realized that it was really love that they were talking about. Hmm. And they went back and re-edited the publication and reformatted it to couch the entire conversation in love, and with the idea that you can love somebody thoroughly and profoundly, even in 45 minutes. and then they distributed it. They drove it around town. They had it. They put it in bookstores. They dropped it off in bars. They made it inescapable in the gay community in the city. And within a year, we started seeing transmission numbers for diseases that we knew how to test for, syphilis and gonorrhea, diving. Yeah. In New York. There was a similar group that was working in San Francisco that produced their own kind of version of safe sex shortly after that, and the numbers started dropping there too. Mm-hmm. So then as we started to spread this news and information through the community, pre-Facebook, pre-Twitter, it reached the far corners. Mm-hmm. And it saved lives.
Yeah. Your book outlines in great detail the failure of institutions, media, church, family, and especially public health and science, in addressing the first decade of the epidemic especially. The list of outrages and indignities was endless. Could you both speak to what the AIDS epidemic taught us about the ways in which scientists and scientific institutions address public health emergencies?
Address or addressed? Because I think those are two different answers. In 81...
Addressed.
So in 81, They were ill-equipped to handle something like this. It was such a fundamental mystery that they didn't know what to do about it. They didn't know how to move on it. Mark mentioned that retroviruses were new, but in 1981, it was believed that retroviruses couldn't cause illness in humans. Even the guy who discovered retroviruses was certain of that. And so what was this, and how do we respond to it? But the more worrisome part, and the thing that I think was the most criminal part of all of this, was that nobody stepped up to try to figure it out. Nobody said, we have a crisis here. Let's get moving on it. And nobody in the public health service, none of our elected officials, neither the mayor of New York nor the mayor of Los Angeles nor the president of the United States even mentioned what was going on. The mayor of San Francisco was more urgent about it, Dianne Feinstein. But there was no leadership. And for years, and it's really hard to imagine, but that for 5 years, the community sat around waiting for drugs to come. 6 years, the community was waiting for drugs to come. It was just assumed that the machinery of big pharma and the research establishment was doing the work behind the scenes, and it turns out they weren't. Like, that was the most shocking thing, that nobody was doing that work. Nobody was finding money and pumping it into research. Nobody was directing that research or setting priorities for that research, setting timelines for that research, declaring an emergency. That's the opening scene to How to Survive a Plague, the documentary, is about, that's in 1989, saying, in 1989, we need the mayor to declare a state of emergency in the city of New York, and still that they weren't getting that kind of traction. And we all know why that was. That was because of what they thought of us and what power they refused to let us have. They refused to let us have power over their empathy. We didn't matter. And that was shocking.
AIDS taught us that, or taught me, but taught us, I think, as a community. I'm speaking not of the gay community, but of the community of people supporting people with HIV, that public health, which sounds so official and doctrinaire, where I work now at Kaiser, if you choose to not take a flu shot, you've got to wear a mask on your face between November and March. It's just a rule. But what public health chooses to do is fueled a lot by attitude and prejudice in this case. And we go back 5 years before the AIDS epidemic to Legionnaires' disease in 1976, which killed between 100 and 200 people in a quick spell. And David, you knew the statistic, how much money was poured in and how much research to quickly put an end to it. Now, again, HIV might have been a more formidable challenge, but clearly in that five-year period and what the public health response was to Legionnaires and HIV clearly showed once again the way we were considered to be, people with HIV were considered to be a dispensable group of people. So AIDS really made me personally lose some faith in the public health structure. And again, applaud the activists who were able to try to compensate for that loss.
Yeah, I think we didn't know how detested we were. I mean, I think we just didn't know. Mm-hmm. And that was a real hard thing to reckon with, yes. that people would allow this to happen. And you go back, as I did for the work on the book, and you discover, as you were pointing out, the federal government threw resources into Legionnaires' disease, and in 6 months they discovered the cause of it and came up with plans, effective plans for eradicating it. And they did that by recruiting and sending epidemiologists around all around that hotel conference thing in Philadelphia, I think it was. When HIV hit, they were cutting those budgets. The first EIS officers from the CDC who came to New York and to San Francisco and Los Angeles to figure out what was going on, within 3 or 4 months, their travel budget was cut. They could no longer travel to figure out what was happening. And the travel the budgets for all of the epidemiology work at the CDC were cut. It was as though they didn't care, or worse, and this fueled people's rage like Larry Kramer's, as though what they were intending to do was to allow this thing to just eradicate the gay community. Mm-hmm. And right. You didn't have to be a mad person to come to that conclusion.
Yeah, one of the, your coverage of the science and the scientific community in this book is remarkable, and just full of intrigue and drama. And I was really stunned at the competitiveness, like the ambition of people like Robert Gallo and Anthony Fauci, who whose duty it was to address this emergency with so many thousands dying, and yet all of these decisions were being made about the epidemic that didn't have to, anything to do with that, but had to do with who was getting credit for something or whose career was advancing. That was really shocking to read.
And shocking to watch it happen.
Yeah, I mean. Yeah.
And indeed, without the activism, which you document so beautifully in the book, who knows how much longer it would have gone on. I mean, there was the science track, and there was the activism track. And of course, they merged and met, conflicted. But where would we have been without ACT UP, without the activism, right. I wonder.
Which is a good segue to my question about ACT UP, right. Which is the ACT UP with its motto, drugs into bodies, forcefully challenged science and big pharma around clinical trials, fast-tracking drugs, drug pricing, and crucially, including affected populations in the process of bringing drugs to market. You wrote that this was the fundamental work of ACT UP, to crack open the secretive and illogical world of pharmacological research and close the gap between scientists and patients. Why did the FDA, NIH, and these other major scientific institutions fail so profoundly in the 80s, and how did ACT UP change them?
Well, as I said before, there was a leadership issue, right? So nobody who was working for those places knew gay people. Or if they did, they weren't saying anything about it. Or if they were gay, they were keeping it quiet. And we know that because ACT UP found them that there were gay people at the NIH, and there were gay people at the National Cancer Institute and the FDA and the CDC. And they built bridges to those people and exploited those relationships, used them as sources for what was going to know what was going on inside. And what they learned was that that the research initiatives that were being undertaken through the 80s were all of the same sort. They were scientists who were racing to find the way to be the very first people to be able to knock out a retrovirus. You know, a very difficult task. But everybody knew that there was gold at the end of that journey, if you're able to do that. And there's a trip to Sweden, right? So, and both of those things are, you know, those are the stuff of scientists' dreams. Mm. Nobody was dying of HIV. HIV was depleting people's immune system, and they were dying of what turned out to be 23 opportunistic infections, that most of which were, many of which were preventable, and many of which were treatable. And nobody was looking for either prevention or treatment of those things. For years, pneumocystis carinii pneumonia was the main killer. And the literature from the 70s told us how to prevent pneumocystis pneumonia.
With Bactrim.
With Bactrim. And it's because people who had organ transplants had to suppress their immune system with certain drugs in order to not reject the organs. Those people often with depleted immune systems came down with PCP. We knew what to do so they would avoid it. Nobody was promulgating that as a technique in HIV. Activists kept going to the federal government, to Tony Fauci and others, saying, we need you to issue guidelines on this. And they would say, you know, we can't, because we don't know if it's going to work in gay people the way it works in organ transplant people, as though gay people are some sort of a special species. And because nobody studied it. So then the activists go, well, study it. And Tony Fauci goes, I can't make people study things. If they don't want to study it, you know, the pure science, pure scientific inquiry means you rely on the curiosity and motivation of the laboratory that's doing the research. You don't tell them what to do. Mm-hmm. But meanwhile, everybody knows it. Everybody with AIDS is dying of PCP. So it's like that kind of inhumane thing that ACT UP just tore the lid off of and said, you're not going to be able to do that anymore. We're not going to allow that to happen. This is this is life and death. And we're going to, if you're not going to set the priority, we're going to set the priority. Mm-hmm. We're going to set the agenda, and we're going to monitor that agenda. We're going to set deadlines, and we're going to make sure we hold your feet to the fire for it. And that was a remarkable intervention, first time ever that patients went to the table like that.
And this is where, in part, you know, pharma, and I will give credit to some of the wonderful things pharma has done, and I will also speak about pharma greed. Why would they study Bactrim when it's already an FDA-approved drug? So that was part of why these studies didn't get done. Nobody was going to make money off of, yes, they'd make some more money if Bactrim had another use, but once something was approved, and this is where I'll speak for a moment just to the LA physician and other provider treating community, we went on our own, as did the New York physicians, the San Francisco physicians, we started giving Bactrim to people. And we said, we're not sure this works yet. We think it works. We're pretty sure it works. And I remember in the healthcare setting in which I work, Kaiser, which I'm very proud of, was giving some people flack for using a drug for an unapproved, you know, for an approved use. And this is where the physician activists came in. And this is where we had to say, this is about people's lives. We have patients that want to do it. And this, in a way, paralleled the birth of the parallel track, which the New York activists got, where people accepted the fact that going on a novel treatment that we weren't sure of could result in a deleterious consequence, but they were willing to take the risk. And I'm very proud of the treating community in LA and other places in the country. And this is where physician activism stepped in. We might not have been marching in the streets all the time, but we were writing prescriptions for things that weren't approved.
Yeah, yeah.
For the doc.
Yeah, I was actually, I was really moved at the lengths to which caregivers took risks in their professions to try to treat their patients with experimental drugs or whatever that might have been. That there were just so many heroes on so many different fronts. I want to ask you, David, to read from one of your final chapters in the book for just a few minutes, that piece about the Lazarus effect, before I ask this question of both of you.
I have it marked. I've practiced. We are in 1996. Early in January, I was at work when the receptionist sent a telephone call to my desk. I recognized the serious Brooklyn accent as Jules Levin's. David, have you heard about the presentation here in Washington? I hadn't. What's up, I said. I'm pulling together a community meeting to talk about it Saturday morning at NYU. 2 days later, after a heavy overnight snowfall, I set out for the NYU Medical Center on foot, as the trains and buses were not running. Levin had invited the virology chiefs from the three pharmaceutical giants involved in protease inhibitor research to speak directly to the infected community. Few people were out in the weather, but as I got close to the lecture hall on First Avenue and 32nd Street, I could tell it was going to be a massive event. More than 1,500 people pushed through the glass door at the hospital, almost all of them gay men, cadavers with thin, straw-like hair folded and bent by their woolen caps. This was far more than could be admitted. In a few weeks, Levin would stage a similar public meeting in Los Angeles on the Paramount lot with a large screen and an overflow tent to accommodate the crowds. But in New York, nearly half of the people in the line, which choked the large foyer and popped out the door and down the block, would be turned away. When the last person was cleared to take a seat, many who remained in the line pressed their ears against the heavy conference doors or waited in the lobby for news to dribble out. I had a seat in the back. One by one, dusty-haired pharmaceutical execs presented findings from their newest studies, referenced in tall graphs projected on the screen behind them. Many of the words and phrases were brand new to most of the community members in the audience. Effective concentrations and viral loads dropping in multiplication units they called logs. We sat motionless in the hushed hall, unable to, for the most part, to comprehend what we were being told. Sensing our disorientation, one of the scientists interrupted the presentation abruptly. "Maybe you're not understanding what we're saying," he said, switching to plain English. this is the biggest news ever in this epidemic. This stuff is actually clearing virus out of people's bodies. People are getting better. We don't know for sure yet, but we think these drugs, this whole class of drugs, might be able to allow people to live a normal life. I felt as though a hand had tightened around my throat. I had trouble breathing. This is what we've been working for all these years, he continued. It's not a cure. We don't know what this stuff is in effect, but this is the first major piece of good news that we have had all these years. They're calling it the Lazarus effect. People who are in hospitals on their last breath are getting up and going back to work. We've never seen anything like it. After years of qualified optimism and marginal advances that never dulled the blade of death, a decade and a half of scientists managing expectations, it was hard to retire skepticism and believe that he was saying anything that made sense. Yet here was a scientist grabbing us by the shirt collar, shaking us. It had been many years since I cried. When I caught my breath again, it came in sobs. Was it over? When the room emptied out, I found myself standing in the sun-creased lobby, watching the men in the audience exchanging hugs. I noticed how incongruously young everybody looked in the snow-whitened light. Most were, like me, not middle-aged. I was 35. The feeling of relief overwhelmed us all. A man I did not know put his hand on my cheek. It startled me. He turned my face toward him. He was perhaps in his mid-20s, blue eyes and radiant. He didn't speak. With a thumb, he wiped my cheek. It was over. It was not over. It would never be over. But it was over.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, one last question. So you wrote that there was no celebration parade held when it was clear protease inhibitors and combination therapy had stopped HIV in its tracks. In the scene you just read, there were tears of joy, but ultimately there was no celebration. This question is for you both. Why was there no parade to celebrate the most important turning point to the plague?
I was at the meeting in January of 96 when that data was presented. And I remember sitting there and seeing the slides of the drop in viral load. And I wrote in the margin of my notes, oh my God, could it be? I don't know. And my answer to Tony's question about why was there not a celebration is, I was afraid as a physician to tell my patients that it was the successful thing that it turned out to be in case I was wrong. Many of us remember when AZT came out in 1987, people gained weight, people felt better, and after 6 months became resistant. I was afraid as a clinician to deliver information with hope that wasn't going to be hopeful ultimately. And the second reason is I remember sitting there. I mean, I've lost so many people to the epidemic, and the two closest, one had just died in September of 95, and the second one, who was my dearest friend, was going to die in March of 96, a couple of weeks hence. And I remember feeling this sense of grief along with the would-be joy. And those are the two reasons why I found I couldn't go out in March. Was it really going to work? And what about all the people we lost?
We also didn't know who was going to work for, and we didn't know anything about the toxicity. And it turns out it was pretty toxic. Strange things started happening to people. It was Crixivan was mm-hmm. the lead drug.
The Crixibelli.
And people's bodies started changing shape, and they developed these huge humps on the back, and their faces were stripped of fat. They had peripheral wasting and truncal obesity. It was strange things were happening on these drugs, and so we didn't know. Nobody knew what was causing that even. So, as great as those numbers looked, and they looked great in everybody, almost everybody who went on the pills, it just didn't seem sustainable. And but those same pharmaceutical chemists stayed in the laboratory, and they perfected the medications, and they perfected the combinations, and you know, today I think we could have that parade with ticker tape and the whole thing. But it was a huge watershed. It just wasn't a perfect watershed. I guess right. That's what we're saying. And it took a year or two or three to know that people, even the people who were the very sickest, might have some sort of a salvage regimen that might be able to bring them through.
When that announcement was made, L.A. County had 8 AIDS units. By the end of 97, there were 0. I mean, time did bear out the amazing result of these drugs, given some of the effects that David speaks of. You know, there were other comorbidities and things that happened, but the dying stopped, not completely by any means, but definitely went down.
I have one more question, and I could have asked another dozen questions. There's so much in your book for us as a community to talk about. Almost also a roadmap to how we might be facing the next 4 years of a Trump-Pence administration. The courage that and heroism that the community went through. So we will be taking questions after I ask my last question. What I think about, this question is for you both. What is the epidemic narrative today? What I think about are things like aging with HIV, how the epidemic disproportionately impacts gay men of color, Truvada as prevention, figuring out how we live when so many of us had been preparing for short lives. How do you see the state of the epidemic today, both epidemiologically and culturally?
Well, I think you hit it. You got it. Those are the issues. Can we prioritize those? I don't know. I was driven to complete this long project of mine on the epidemic because I wanted to find out what were the conditions of survival. What did it mean to survive? What did it mean to experience that unrelenting death for so long? You know, a mass death experience, and to come through the other side. And I was drawn to do that because of the people who I'd follow all those years, all those activists who had done such brilliant work. After 1996, they found themselves really destabilized. And I think the community of activists, maybe the whole community of AIDS, was destabilized by the suddenness of the lifting of the clouds. Mm. And, you know, not much has been studied. Not much effort has been put into studying survivors of mass death experiences. Yeah. So there's been a lot of good writing about the Holocaust.
Yeah.
There's been some interesting writing about the atomic bombing of Japan. But nobody's tied these things together. So I wanted to use those tools to see if I could understand what it meant to us to lose a generation.
Yeah.
Mm. No answer yet. And one of the people I write about, Spencer Cox, died in 2013. And after his death, in his honor, a movement has begun to address what they're calling AIDS survivor syndrome. Mm-hmm. ACT UP was always very, had a kind of a dark humor about everything. So AIDS survivor syndrome. They wanted to call it Spencer Cox AIDS Survivor Syndrome Foundation. They were going to call for a Spencer Cox Ass Foundation. He was very proud of his ass. But he's just one of many people. There was an epidemic of crystal meth that followed almost immediately. The same community, the same people, almost immediately after HIV became less of a terrifying and fatal disease, comes this other thing. What does that mean? Like, why were we doing that? And what caused that, and what can we understand about that, and what can we learn really about human limits and human capacity and the human soul by looking at what happened in this time. So that's what I would advocate.
I would thank you. I would also, as David says, speak of the compassion that opened up for most of us through the epidemic, and to remember that it's far from over. And you ask yourself, what is there left to do? Well, you brought up some of the points. And I want to present an image that was presented to me by one of the heroes of the epidemic for me, Jerry Koash from Shanti, known to some of you in this room. And it has relevance for the next 4 years. Jerry, at the Shanti training in July of 1985, with 90 volunteers in the room, said in his beautiful, soft voice, he said, the life of a person with AIDS is a very, very dark place. Sometimes as volunteers, as helpers, we try to go in there and turn on all the light switches and flood the room with light and make everything okay. And Jerry said, what I urge you to do is just be the person that lights that first candle, that puts the first light to relieve the darkness. So I'm of a mindset, and how I've made it through the epidemic without, I don't think I've ever burnt out, is trying to do just my one little thing and not take it all on. So tomorrow, Bob and I are going to buy lots of Kellogg cereal, because what happened today? You know, it's one thing to do, and I'm not the kind of person to kind of get the whole picture, but that's something, and again, I'm grateful to Jerry and I'm grateful to the AIDS epidemic for leaving me with this notion that any individual thing we do, every family in the Penn neighborhood to be who hung out a rainbow flag, you know, they're doing a wonderful thing. So I encourage all of us as we go through the next weeks, months, and years to just examine ourselves and look at something we can do. And again, look at something we can do yet for the HIV epidemic, far from over.
Well, thank you, Mark, and thank you, David, for your immense contributions to our community and for this conversation tonight. And I'm looking forward to the questions that folks will now ask you.
Thank you, Tony. Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much for the talk tonight and the book so far. I just started reading it today. It's phenomenal.
Thank you.
My question is about the period right before the epidemic hit. And you mentioned in the early chapters of the book that Dr. Sonnabend saw an increase in his practice in inflammation of lymph node infection in the, I'm assuming, mid to late 70s. And you obviously have some staggering statistics early on about, in 1982, the blood supply of gay men in San Francisco and New York was found to have staggering rates of HIV, something like 46% in San Francisco, I think 25% in New York. Mm-hmm. Besides for Larry Kramer, who seemed to have this anticipatory panic in the late 70s about promiscuity and what it could mean in the gay community, did you interview any other long-term survivors that seemed to, you know, of course, hindsight's 2020, but seemed to have some, you know, I kind of remember thinking something might have been going on at the time, right before the epidemic started?
That's an interesting question. You know, in fact, I think just the opposite. It was Edmund White who wrote that every new sexually transmitted infection is a badge of honor in the war for sexual liberation. And people believed that. People believed that it was just something you went in and got fixed. And so for the most part, I think that there was this understanding that it was just a simple medical problem. Larry Kramer took a different position, and he started that in the late 70s. And I believe, and I say it in the book, that he had that he was driven by anger over a relationship that he lost. And he just couldn't tame. He had a boyfriend who was feral. He was just gorgeous and feral on Fire Island, and he couldn't tame him. And that made him really mad, and he blamed sex, not the boyfriend. He blamed the world, not the boyfriend. And he went out to burn that world down. He wrote a book that was just awful. Like, nobody liked that book.
Mm-hmm. Faggots.
It was called Faggots. I can't even believe he liked that book. It was a very thinly veiled Ramona Clay about his boyfriend, who parodied as a guy named Dinky. Like, it was grotesque. And the thing is still in print. I don't know how that could be, but an artifact of a time. And so when HIV came, he thought, I mean, he actually consciously said to himself, like, see? Like, you know, this proves it. And by that time, he had been ostracized from the community, and so he used HIV as a way to come back in, saying, like, look, you shouldn't throw me out. You know, I wasn't the Chicken Little. Look, it's actually happening. So it's just an interesting chapter in history, but I don't believe that he saw a disease coming. I think he also saw something kind of unhuman about the kind of sexual activity that people were having then. He saw it as having no greater purpose than the bonobos, you know, what is the human heart and what should it be looking for and what is the human soul and how does it enrich itself? And he didn't see the idea that this kind of community that had come together and was celebrating the way it was doing some of that. Mm-hmm. So thanks for the question.
Next question right over here. Are they doing long-term follow-up studies on survivors and also on the people who... I'm not sure if survivors is the right term, but the people who are using these drugs for years and years and years?
There are plenty of studies of so-called long-term survivors, and the current belief, I would say, just based on culling together these studies, would be that, yes, some people are more hospitable hosts or more voracious offenders of the virus when it's inside of them, but that the single biggest factor is the kind of virus that you get and how much of it you get. And the people who are long-term survivors maybe got a smaller inoculation, maybe their immune system kicked in better. But one of the things I want to say that in Los Angeles, a point I didn't get to make, for those of us in the audience who are involved in the epidemic, not to exclude New York or San Francisco from this, but we know that we were filled with spirit and love and Louise Hay's Hayride, Marion Williamson's Course of Miracles, Sally Fisher's AIDS Mastery. We were all over each other doing Sufi dances to the greatest love of all. And no, this is a very, very significant part of the sustenance we got from the epidemic. And we believe there was an organization that I helped co-found in 1987 called PLUS, Positive Living for Us, which believed that if you did the right things in terms of diet and meditation and nutrition, that would be the single biggest way of overcoming the epidemic. And again, I'm all for that. I'm still all for that. But I think we know a virus is still a virus. So fortunately, there are people. I started an HIV clinic at Kaiser in 1988. And one of the patients I saw last week was in my first clinic in August of that year. He's a long-term survivor. Maybe he's here tonight. If he is, he would say so, because he's very outspoken. so anyway, that's a little bit of what... It's still being studied.
I love your movie so much. I've watched it probably four or five times since it came out, and I'm really looking forward to reading the book. Yeah. One thing that struck me when I watched the film when it first came out was... I came of age in San Francisco during the epidemic, and I knew it was going on because my coworkers were getting sick, my roommates were getting sick, things like that. But it almost seemed like I don't know if it was just the people I was running around with at the time, but the political activism seemed like it was mostly centered in New York. And do you attribute that? I mean, was that the case? Am I incorrect on that? And do you attribute that to just like that New York is larger and is also a more was at the time a more geographical power center? Am I right on that? That most of the activism was happening in New York that had the biggest impact?
It's very interesting. I describe in the book that the period in the 70s, late 70s, mid to late 70s and into the 80s was like the largest migration of gay people in America from America to the coasts, and the coasts had various draws. Like New York had a kind of a New York personality, and if you felt like you were that kind of person, that's the community that you went to. And San Francisco and LA had their own kind of characters, psychological characters, and I believe that those characters informed the way the various cities responded to the epidemic. And New York was the epicenter. It had 50% of the cases through into the 90s. It had the largest caseload. So the gay community was very concentrated in New York and in just a number of neighborhoods. So we started seeing really early on how this was going to really threaten the community. And New York did respond the way New Yorkers did. Shanti Project is kind of a West Coast response. The East Coast response was more of a furious one, more impatient. But while there was activism on both coasts, beginning from the first winks of the epidemic, it wasn't until 1987 that the activism took a real sharp turn, and that was the creation of this kind of like rageful, but ultimately very clever grassroots kind of activism in the form of ACT UP. Did start there, but chapters formed all over the place. At its peak, 147 chapters around the world. And they all were doing the same sort of work, and they were treatment activists like the kind that I write about and focus on in all of those cities. But New York really kind of set a tone, I think, for activism.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to just add to that I think the discussion is yet to be had, if not tonight, down the road over the next few years. I do agree that our activism here was a different flavor. I call it the activism of compassion. It's not to say that New York did not act with compassion, but I remember thinking that we had not the monopoly, but we had all of these ways of helping people go at it in a way we were very appreciative of New York for being there, and of course more proximal to Washington. And the people who had the spirit then, and we had ACT UP here, we had marches, we had a lot of activism. It was definitely, though, a different flavor. And I my tongue is tied. I haven't figured that out yet.
It's a good way to put it, that it was that the caring response to the epidemic and to the illness was really generated on the West Coast.
Yeah.
And the East Coast was all about the fight the system. An eye for an eye at first, and a demand that it end. So what was being created, I think, in the West Coast in a really effective way that really informed how the rest of the world responded to AIDS was, the establishing of structures and rituals and comfort to help the dying on their journey.
I recall scenes in your book where the New York activists are sort of seeing what's happening, say, in San Francisco, and find it sort of peculiar, but intriguing too. It was just a real different way of approaching.
There's that great scene when the two coasts meet for the very first time in 1983. They get together at a health conference in Denver, and so it's people with AIDS from across the land, and they all get together in a room. There's maybe 15 of them, and the New Yorkers are freaked out about all the hugging that the West Coast people are doing. It just didn't make any sense to them.
Right. Another brief, just a brief anecdote to typify the West Coast response. My dear friend Ron Cummins, 1946 to 1986, when he was left brain, CPA, when he was diagnosed in 1984, he went into the Bodhi Tree bookstore, known to many of you, and he said, "Hey, I was told to come here. I have AIDS. I need help." And the salesperson said to him, totally straight on, "Well, do you want to live or want to die? We have books to help you with. We have books to help you with both."
Hey, hi. My name's Colin Campbell. I moved to New York in 1982 to go to NYU, and I lived there till 1997. Been through it all. I was a volunteer at St. Vincent's for over a year. The whole drill. So anyway, first of all, I agree with you about Mr. Kramer's book, that first book, but I also think that he wrote a masterpiece of that era in The Normal Heart. It's the masterpiece of the era, and I think I just wanted to add that. Anyway, I was at this activist meeting last night in response to the Trump presidency, over 1,000 people in a room. Mm. Bo Willimon of House of Cards is putting this together. So we're all there in the room. And we're going into issues, women's issues, gay issues, the environment, so forth. And I'm like, oh, I'll just go with the gays, because I've always been with the gays. I worked with ACT UP and all of that. So we're getting together, and all of a sudden, ACT UP people are there from California. And they're saying, we're going to have to re-energize. And we're realizing, and this is a question I'm getting to. we're going to have, because there's the possibility of all this funding being lost for young people, for Truvada, for all of this. So it's dawning on us, the men like me in their 40s and their 50s that went through all of this, we're going to have to lead them, perhaps, into this new era. How do you feel that? Because we're talking a lot about the past, which is great, but the activism really did save us. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people don't understand the power of that. So how do you feel about this whole generation? How are they going to learn this and quickly?
I think you're absolutely right. You have to teach them. You know, the AIDS activism took a different form than any other kind of activism. It innovated. It built on the experiences of previous movements, of the anti-war movement, of the women's movement, of the women's health movement, of the civil rights movement, and then added their own insights and experience, and they came up with a model that's really applicable to other movements today, and it's been replicated in some part by the Black Lives Matter movement that has consciously looked to that period. In fact, is queer and trans led. And with those people bringing to the Black Lives Matter movement their own experiences, it's been used as a model in other parts of the world. How to Survive a Plague, the documentary, was being screened in underground screenings in Moscow in 2012, 2013, at the height of the Pussy Riot, pro democracy movement that was being pursued so violently by the government. And they were just taking it apart. They were watching the movie and stopping it and saying, "What do we learn here? How do we learn to respond to failure? And what kind of strategy can we get from this that we can apply to that?" So when I sat down to write the book, I thought I would try to see if I could lay bare that blueprint, and it's really a clever new way to organize and to make change. And I think that's if today's movement, who knows what we're going to be fighting when Trump comes into power? We just don't know. But if we don't go back and build on that, if we try to start again, I think we're going to be in more trouble than we're already in.
So my question is: does that exhaust you or energize that whole idea?
I think it has to be energizing. I mean, I think it's the story of AIDS activism is a story of triumph. It's a story of success. And that's what's so incredible about it. Like, they did it.
Yeah, I was telling David that I was reading your book this month, when we had this awful election, and it, oddly gave me comfort that we've been through so much worse and responded so beautifully and powerfully, and we can do it again. Yeah. Do we have time for one more? I think we have time for just one more question. Yeah.
If my eyes don't deceive me, I think that's Bill T. Jones on the image between Tony and David, which made me think of one other sort of tentacle to the conversation, which was about the artistic and creative response, mm-hmm. Because there was so much that came out of the epidemic and still does, and seminal works that I think were satisfying to people creating them to get out grief and anger and happiness and everything else, but also that allowed the general public to maybe find out about stuff they hadn't heard about, and just things happening here, like through highways, or Louise mentioned From a Burning House, all the writing groups. So I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about the importance of the artistic and creative response, especially during the worst time in the crisis.
It was galvanizing. It was motivating. You know, ACT UP, I don't think, would have formed without the an earlier movement of artists who had kind of laid the groundwork, and then, and I detail this in the book, the arrival suddenly overnight of Silence Equals Death posters all over mm-hmm. New York City, and they were designed. It took 9 months to come up with that design by a collective that was an underground collective of artists. They called themselves the Silence Equals Death Collective, and they knew that they wanted to use art to move people to action, and it worked. You know, and ACT UP continued, and all the activism thereafter continued to rely on, you know, visual art, theatrical art, video art, and which I reflect in the documentary, to reflect back to the community, to interpret, but also to push forward, to encourage forward, and to celebrate the successes as they came. So really an essential part of it, I think.
Thank you. Well, thank you, David. Thank you, Mark. Thank you, Aloud Series in the City of West Hollywood. And thank you all for being here tonight. We're going to have
Rather Kruder, psychologist.
Now.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the Estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolfe, Julia Meltzer, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM. Music by Boya Pongo. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit lfla.org for more information. 17.